We will start this session. I'm Levi Peterson, and I will serve as a moderator. For several years, Dialogue has pursued a special series of articles on the LDS Church in countries and cultures beyond the usual Anglo-American sphere of influence. And we have published in Dialogue one or two articles at a time in a number of issues rather than a single issue devoted entirely to the topic. And the series was initially proposed and carried out by Armin Moss and Ethan Jorgensen, and then I have continued it after they were through with their effort on it. This panel today is an outgrowth of that project. And I won't do a great deal by way of introducing the speakers, though I'll stand and briefly introduce each one as we proceed. And we will go in the order that you see in the program with Stephen Tyler and Sam Peterson, Francine Bennion, and Bert Wilson. The first presenter, then following the formal the formal presentations, we will have a question and answer period. Our first panelist will be Stephen Tyler, retired chemical engineer, missionary in Russia, including Siberia, and presently pursuing an exceedingly pleasant vocation as a summering in the Yellowstone area in some kind of a part-time paid way. I've never grasped entirely. Maybe Steve can explain that, but I'm glad to present Stephen Tyler.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to present here. My present vocation is not part-time, I'm full-time. I'm a lackey in the Signal Mountain Lodge Company in Teton National Park, not in Yellowstone, so incorrect in a detail or two there, but very pleasant summer. While I have lived most of my life in parts of the United States where Mormons are in a small minority, I was born in Provo, Utah, and I attended Provo High School, where I attended seminary, where I met Linda, who is now my wife. So I'm very much a product of the Wasatch Front culture. My faith has not been static through my life, and I now consider myself to be a liberal, though active Mormon. I graduated from the University of Utah with a degree in chemical engineering, and I've had a happy, though unremarkable, career in that field. In 1999, at the age of 57, Linda and I decided to retire, and we submitted our papers to be called on a mission. We were called to serve as CES missionaries in Novosibirsk, Russia, right in the middle of Siberia. While many of you of my generation will understand my reservations about going to Russia and to Siberia, it was the CES part of that call that gave me the greatest concern. In my mind at that time, CES was the absolute antithesis of Mormon liberalism, and I had serious concerns whether I could be true to myself and serve in a CES mission. Linda persuaded me that we could retain control of our mission, and in fact, we had very little conflict with CES. In reality, we experienced a degree of synergy as we brought our point of view to the CES program. We were determined to learn and to respect as much as we could about Russian culture and heritage, and that turned out to be a huge but very enjoyable task, for it's a culture that has rich histories and traditions. But I'm afraid we fell short of our goal. The line between teaching the gospel of Jesus Christ as we understand it and teaching American culture is sometimes hard for us to recognize and it's impossible for the young Russians to recognize. As CES missionaries, we work almost exclusively with young people who are very interested in American culture. They anxiously access the readily available sources of information about our culture, which is mainly TV shows and movies that glamorously portray the harshest aspects of what we are. So I felt the need to point out that TV shows like Law and Order don't tell the stories of good, virtuous Americans who are devoted to families and live by moral principles. And in fact, I love my country, and I like to talk about it. And I should. And they like to hear me talk about it, and they should. And while I'm interested in hearing them talk about their country, they tend to be more conscious of the faults and flaws within their culture. And so it goes. We did avail ourselves of the opportunity to attend the ballet theater in Russia at every opportunity. And often we attended with our Russian friends. They were pleased that we appreciated that aspect of their culture. The fine arts are an easy way to come to love and understand the depth of the Russian heritage. Gospel teachings have a lot to offer to Russian culture in a cultural sense, and it is a good fit with the traditional family and social values. The lack of materialism in the old Russian traditions is a better fit with the gospel values than in our own materialistic culture. And I should point out that there is a very materialistic culture developing in Russia, but the old traditional values in Russia are non-materialistic, a very good fit with the gospel. And so the gospel can do much to enhance good traditional Russian values while addressing the crushing effects of social vices like alcoholism within that society. So are these interactions always positive? Of course they are not. I'd like to share with you an experience that we had in one of four young single adult conferences that we assisted in while we were in Russia. Each of these conferences lasted for 3 days. They were mission-wide, and young single adults from all over the mission attended. It was the highlight of our mission, and it was very enjoyable by all who attended. At the last of these conferences that I attended, we asked the mission president, not me, but the young people who organized this, asked the mission president and a visiting area authority to meet in an informal question and answer session following lunch. While the formal session occurred in the morning, this after lunch session was to be more of a get to know you time when questions could be asked and suggestions made. At the appointed time, we gathered in the hall for the meeting and were disappointed that neither the mission president nor the area president were there. Over the course of the hour, missionaries bore testimonies and we tried as best we could to salvage something from the time with predictably little success. The featured guests arrived well after the meeting had concluded and apologized for losing track of time while on a sightseeing tour of the city. This contemptuous behavior was offensive enough to one particular young woman who had served a full-time missionary and was now serving as president of the Relief Society, that she told me she would not return to church again, and I believe she has stood by that threat. While this is the most egregious example of leadership contempt that I experienced, it is by no means the only example of American leaders showing a decided lack of consideration for local people. Contempt of little people is not a unique quality of American culture. It's the right claimed by the privileged class in all cultures, and unhappily, it is sometimes true within the church culture. To the extent that we establish a privileged class among our leaders, we enable those who would claim that right of contempt. Surely there is justification for a mission president or area president to have a driver and a mission vehicle. The business of running a mission requires that they have access to those kinds of vehicles. But when that relationship evolves into a chauffeur-driven SUV that serves to create the appearance of opulence and privilege, when mission homes become homes that reflect opulence far beyond the need of mission function, when we feel that we must rise to our feet when a leader enters the room, the message is clear, and sometimes very good men fall victim to that adulation. My experience suggests that materialism and the presumed right of luxurious living are the areas where we are most likely to confuse American culture with the value with the values of the gospel. And this is most likely to occur at the leadership level, where we feel that calling entitles a leader to levels of comfort and luxury where it is neither necessary nor appropriate to gospel servants. Let me turn my attention to another aspect that deserves some attention. That is drawing the lines between matters of consequence and inconsequential differences in our culture. As is true in many cultures, the drinking of tea is ubiquitous. Practically any invitation into a Russian home will include a cup of tea. Among members of the church, this is the acceptable herbal tea that any of us would drink. But among non-members, it is generally the green tea, a violation of the word of wisdom. As a church member, like myself, I'm faced with the dilemma of whether to decline the tea and make the awkward explanation, or accept a gracious offer and drink it, and perhaps repent afterwards. Since many of the non-member friends that we formed, friendships that we formed, had little to do with the church, we decided that we would accept tea and accept that gesture of kindness. It seemed to us that the sin of offending our host was greater than the sin of drinking the tea. And so I often drank green tea in Russia, a sin that I will probably have trouble repenting of, because I have trouble feeling remorse for that sin. A similar argument could be made for accepting vodka, which is often used in the same way for the same purpose in Russian society. But that's a line that we never crossed, even at the expense of offending our host, and in making the awkward explanations or both. It seems to me that the difference is clear, though hard to articulate. And if we can't recognize that kind of difference, then we will be constantly mired in issues of little consequence at the expense of the real substantive contributions that we might otherwise make. We need to come to understand that there are fuzzy lines and there are distinct lines in our exercise of obedience. And if we see only the distinct lines, then we will surely fall victim to those views that reject any culture but our own. Among young elders and sisters, this will be difficult to teach, but I think there are some things that we can do. In our mission, we use the term outrageous obedience to encourage missionaries to follow every rule to the letter. It is clearly a concept adapted to the needs of the most immature 19-year-old elders, and probably is helpful in their cases. But outrageous obedience denies the need for mature people to make value judgments appropriate to differing situations. As I mentioned, Linda and I determined that we would retain control of our mission, and that no one would define our mission without our consent. While that control was readily granted to us, it was done so with a wink and a nod, and not in any formal way, not in any way that would empower the most immature 19-year-old elders. And generally, we did what needed to be done. There was never any conflict with leadership over matters of obedience. To a lesser degree, the more mature young elders and sisters were given that same wink and a nod, and they acted responsibly with the latitude they were given. While serving in Russia, we came to know the young sisters and elders very well, and we came to appreciate the great value that this experience was having in their lives. Because we had less opportunity and less ability to learn the language, we never had quite the contact with Russian life that the young people had. While they were less acquainted with the depth of the Russian culture than would be desired, they visited in the homes and grew to love the Russian people with an intimacy that was not possible for us. They came to know what it felt like to be Russian, to be poor, to struggle with the unique issues associated with surviving in that system. And they were changed by that experience, and they learned things about their fellow men that they could not have learned in any other way. At the same time, the Russian people with whom they interacted received many of the same blessings as they were exposed to good, positive Americans who, in many ways, stand for the very best that our country has to offer. There's no denying that American culture influenced these interactions, but the flow ran both ways, and both cultures benefited from that exchange. So in conclusion, I believe that the positive benefits that accrue to the church and to missionaries and to residents of a foreign country far outweigh the detrimental effects associated with American missionary efforts. Nonetheless, there are some things that I'd like to see changed to address the problems of cultural insensitivity that I've mentioned. In a way, keeping the baby while throwing out the bathwater, if you will. First of all, we should reject outrageous obedience and replace it with a concept of Christian obedience, a concept that says, is this what Jesus would have me do in this situation? Many mission presidents empower their missionaries to make those kinds of choices, and they understand that the potential for abuse by the most immature missionaries is justified by the benefits that accrue to the rest of us. Second, when we left for our mission, we spent 10 weeks in the senior MTC, where we learned, among other things, that it was disrespectful to refer to the missionary training session, or the missionary training center, as the MTC. Despite this kind of excess, we also learned enough Russian that we showed respect for their language, showed that we were trying. We also learned to love a young Russian teacher who generously shared her culture with us. Senior missionaries and mission presidents no longer have such an opportunity, and the cultural sensitivity that comes from that kind of preparation must be gained now after they're in the mission field. I'd like to see a more structured approach to include some cultural training for our leaders. Third, and most of all, we ought to do everything in our power to eliminate the privileged class mentality that exists among church leaders in foreign lands. Mission homes and mission offices ought to be designed for their functionality. Vehicles should be modest in size and model while still suitable for the necessary functions that they serve. It should be clear to an outside observer that the drivers are engaged in a mission business, that they are not the chauffeurs of the president and their families. And finally, we ought not to stand out of respect whenever a church leader enters the room. We ought to try to avoid those gestures that encourage leaders to think of themselves as exceptional, and we should not do those things that would enable or empower those who would abuse their position. If missionaries are to be effective in places like Russia, we need to adapt the message to both respect and build upon the deep culture and cultural heritage that our host country and people. As we do this, both the missionaries and the church will be changed in very positive ways.
Our next presenter will be Sam Peterson, native of Logan and St. George, a very recent graduate from BYU Law School. In fact, he staggered out of the bar exam yesterday afternoon. and will be practicing law in Provo for this coming year. He served as a missionary in Mexico, and he will address work from that perspective. Sam.
I did take the professional responsibility exam yesterday, so I'm freshly minted. Just what the world needs, right? Another lawyer. In contemplating this panel's topic of inappropriate intrusions of American culture, I based my insights on my experience serving a mission in the Mexican states of Veracruz and Oaxaca. I served my mission fairly recently after the church had been well established in the area with scores of stakes and even a temple. The strength of the church in the area allowed me to experience the culture of a vibrant and self-supporting division of the church. While serving in Mexico, I noticed many cultural traits among the saints of Veracruz that I would deem to be cultural intrusions. In my judgment, most of these cultural intrusions were not inappropriate and only served to make a peculiar people even more peculiar. However, a few of the cultural intrusions seem inappropriate and likely inhibit the growth of the church in Mexico. I will begin my comments by outlining the cultural intrusions that I consider harmless and then move on to the more inappropriate ones. The first cultural intrusion that I would like to speak about is basketball. Basketball is a fairly rare sport in Mexico, yet it is played regularly among the members. Indeed, within hours of stepping off the plane in Mexico, I played a few games of basketball at a basketball court which was appurtenant to a Veracruz Stake Center. Among the culture at large, basketball is rarely played. It is overshadowed, obviously, by soccer and, to a lesser extent, baseball. In Mexico, the basketball court is also rare. I only recall seeing two or three basketball courts outside of church property. However, every single LDS meeting house or stake center had a basketball court. Some of these basketball courts were laid out according to American rules, and others were laid out according to Latin American rules, with the key wider under the basket than at the foul line. These courts were all located outdoors within a stone's throw of the stake center or meeting house. Members, especially younger members, would regularly play basketball on these courts. Members also use courts for parties and, in some cases, for parking lots. It is interesting to note that basketball courts at the more recently constructed stake centers and meeting houses double as the smaller indoor rules soccer courts. Indeed, there's outdoor soccer that we know is played outside on a large grassy field, but there's also indoor soccer, which is played on a smaller court, kind of like a basketball court. In these dual-purpose courts, basketball standards, the soccer goals were placed at either end of the basketball court, and then the basketball standard was perched atop the goal's crossbar. Beyond playing the game of basketball, many Mexican saints seem to have an uncommon knowledge of the NBA, and especially the Jazz. Though younger men were generally more likely to be fans, I remember a middle-aged sister who regularly watched the Jazz. Another innocuous cultural intrusion that is not outwardly apparent as basketball is manifest in the Mexican saints' familiarity with certain types of American foods. Though hamburgers and hot dogs are about as common in Mexico as tacos and burritos are here in America, the Mexican saints have an affinity for certain American foods that the majority of Mexicans do not even know about. A prime example is the brownie. As far as I know, the brownie is unknown among the Mexican culture at large. To me, this is ironic because the ancestors of the Mexican people were the first to have domesticated the cocoa bean. However, church members in various cities made what they called brownies and shared them with the missionaries. To a lesser extent than the brownie, Mexican saints have an uncommon familiarity or affinity for root beer, peanut butter, and beef jerky, all foods not widely consumed in Mexico. I believe that the Mexican saints became familiar with these items through contact with gringo missionaries to whom these food items are coveted reminders of home. Likewise, pizza, though widely available in Mexico, among the saints is considered missionary food. Indeed, the food of the majority of zone conferences in the Veracruz mission was catered by Domino's. This pizza was a highlight for both gringo elders and their Mexican counterparts, which made up more than half of the mission. Interestingly, the few times the conference meals weren't catered by Domino's, they were catered by KFC, which cooks chicken in a way not common to Mexico. Speaking of poultry, various Mexican saints celebrated Thanksgiving, or the Día de Acción de Gracias, by eating a turkey with stuffing, cranberries, and potatoes. I do not think that this overtly American holiday is celebrated by other Mexicans. An American Mormon cultural trait related to food that has not strongly manifested itself in Mexican culture is the aversion to caffeine in soft drinks. Among Mexican saints, as among Mexicans of any faith, Coca-Cola runs like water. Some people have Coke delivered to their house on a daily basis in a similar manner as some people here in Utah have milk delivered to their house. One woman I knew even referred to Coca-Cola as la leche negra, or black milk. The rejection of this American cultural trait was so strong that my mission president, a Guatemalan who lived in Mexico, admonished the entire mission to drink Coca-Cola because it was safer than drinking the water. While food, drink, and basketball courts are physical manifestations of cultural intrusions, an even more tangible manifestation comes in the form of CTR rings and consecrated oil vials. CTR rings are a superfluous cultural intrusion that is not closely associated with church doctrine or church ordinance. However, HLJ rings, Oslo Justo rings, are as popular among Mexican saints as CTR rings are among Utah saints. Though consecrated oil vials are not as superfluous to the religion as CTR rings, they have assumed a role similar to the CTR ring among the Mexican saints. Like CTR rings, vials have become boundary objects and a means for saints to identify each other as saints. It is ubiquitous for a non-member from Veracruz to use an ornate metal bottle opener as a keychain and to allow the bottle opener to hang outside of his pants pocket. Mormon men do the same, replacing the bottle opener with a consecrated oil vial. These vials are large and fairly ornate. Some containing enough consecrated oil for a disaster of biblical proportions or a salad of regular proportions. Let's see. I actually have one. As you can see, it's fairly large. If this is being recorded, I'm holding up a vial. It's about 3 inches across, and it's got various waved segments into it. It's divided into 7 segments, and according to my friend, Brother Ron Hill, who gave it to me, each segment stands for one of the 7 dispensations. And it would be used like this. I don't know if you can see, it's hanging outside my front pants pocket. Like the phylacteries of old, these vials send a strong signal. I have the priesthood and I'm not afraid to use it. Um, Though CTR rings and consecrated oil vials are conspicuous cultural intrusions, I do not think that they are inappropriate cultural intrusions, nor do I think that they limit the growth of the church in any way. Neither do basketball courts or American food items, the other items that I have spoken of thus far. Though idiosyncratic and even campy, these cultural traits are harmless to the growth of the church and only serve to accentuate the peculiarity of an already peculiar people. However, a few cultural intrusions I notice seem problematic, inappropriate, and even detrimental to the growth of the church. One such intrusion was the gringo culture found embedded in certain auxiliary publications of the church, such as church videos and certain church manuals. I refer to videos such as On the Way Home, Together Forever, and The Prodigal Son. Though the translation of these videos has removed the English language, the culture portrayed within these videos indicates that they were created primarily for members of the American middle class. For example, On the Way Home depicts an upper middle class family whose daughter dies, the family's struggle with the loss, and the ultimate resolution of the struggle when the family accepts the plan of salvation and is baptized. Though any culture can relate to the loss of a family member, the video included depictions of middle-class life that an average Mexican of lower economic status may find hard to relate to or even off-putting. This example would not be so problematic if it were the only one. Together Forever, The Prodigal Son, and the majority of church films released in Spanish appear to target the American middle class as the intended audience. Maybe I was just being overly sensitive, but there were times when I felt uncomfortable showing such films to people who I knew lived in serious poverty. The cultural bias presented in Mormon videos also exists in certain church manuals such as the Missionary Guide and the Temple Marriage Class Teacher's Manual. When I entered the MTC, the church issued me two copies of the Missionary Guide, one in English and one in Spanish. The Spanish version appeared to be an exact translation, preserving metaphors, comparisons, and assumptions that did not seem as effective in the context of the Mexican culture. I realized that the church replaced the Missionary Guide with the manual called Preach My Gospel. However, the cultural dissonance found in the Missionary Guide serves as an example of a continuing problem. Indeed, a good friend of mine who recently served her mission in Russia indicated to me that she commonly encountered cultural dissonance while teaching from the Temple Marriage Class Teacher's Manual. In conclusion, there is no question that the church is unintentionally exporting American cultural traits. Of the cultural intrusions that I witnessed while serving my mission in Veracruz, Mexico, most were benign and only contributed to the peculiarity of an already peculiar people. These innocuous traits include basketball, American food items, CTR rings, and consecrated oil vials. However, cultural bias embedded in auxiliary church publications may be detrimental to the growth of the church because these publications were clearly intended for the American middle-class viewers and are hard for the average Mexican to relate to. Thank you.
It occurs to me that oil vial that Sam showed us could also be used as a defensive weapon if necessary. Our next presenter will be Francine Bennion, who grew up in Canada but has, as you see in the program, a first-hand experience with LDS life in many countries beyond the United States and beyond Canada for that matter. She has lived much of her adult life in Provo as a faculty wife. Her husband is a retired professor of clinical psychology, and Francine herself has served as an adjunct instructor in honors programs, and she's a fine musician. So, Francine, please.
One correction, the experience is not always my first-hand experience, but that of friends and relatives who have told me what they experienced. I'm long gone from my youth in Canada, and much has changed. When I was young, English law and education framed the diverse community of people from many places, first and second generation immigrants. I was unaware of prejudice and bias within that frame, but it existed. I didn't know that no Mormon was allowed to teach school in Lethbridge, Alberta, until World War II made it necessary because there was no one else to fill a vacancy. I was unaware that in an official meeting, I read decades later, city council members referred to some immigrants as garlicky-breathed bohunks. I was unaware that, I guess I should read the notes. I was unaware that the application by a Canadian-born woman for a cleaning job at the hospital was denied because her parents were from Japan, and, quote, surely we can find a good white woman for the job. In 1982, Canada amended its constitution with a much-needed Charter of Human Rights and Freedoms, which specifies fundamental human freedoms of conscience, religion, thought, belief, opinion, and expression. It mandates equal protection and benefit of law to every Canadian within only the limits necessary for a functioning democracy, and forbids any discrimination based on race, national or ethnic origin, color, religion, sex, age, or mental or physical disability. Equality is a fundamental human right legally mandated. Hutterites, Mormons, and Mennonites may practice their own gender roles and rules but cannot attempt to impose them on anyone else. While some Canadians may seek a church that affirms the authority of tradition, most are unlikely to embrace a church that deifies inequalities and inequities. Regarding equal rights for women and for homosexuals, unless they ignore the issues, Canadian Mormons cannot in their hearts honor, obey, and sustain both the law and their prophet. Beyond questions of which authority to obey or whose punishment to avoid, LDS Canadians who actively seek what is right, what is consistent with their core constructs of goodness and godliness, face disjunction between the heart of the law and the heart of their religion. Because LDS leaders consider gender rules to be neither cultural heritage nor human decision, but rather divine mandate, resolution is challenging to thoughtful members and investigators. The Canadian Charter reflects a national attempt at harmonious neighborly living among persons in a great melting pot, a community as diverse as any on earth. LDS church leaders working to develop their own global community of diverse persons have a more difficult task. Rather than developing a productive community of persons who retain their own beliefs, opinions, thoughts, actions, and consciences, as do Canadians, church members attempt to change and standardize these according to their own definitions. An additional difficulty is that some suppose that centrally mandated policies and procedures all are or should be divine and therefore universally perfect, not simply the best that good persons with their own language and understanding have been able to devise in earnest service to God and neighbor. As I consider forms and procedures in our church and the American business model adopted to manage its growth, and the details of sad or funny experiences between our American church and Cambodian Zulus, Marshallese, Taiwanese, Samoans, Welsh, Hopis, and the French, for example, Jesus' parable of the Good Samaritan keeps popping unexpectedly into my mind. I've heard the parable presented as though to teach Jesus' people to give kindness and love to all, even to despised neighbors. But in Jesus' account, the Jew does not give to the Samaritan. Rather, the Jew receives from the Samaritan. A core construct for Americans in general, and members of our church in particular, has been that we are the givers, the leaders, the deliverers of truth, the teachers of less blessed others, not only in our religious life, but also in our political and military. We are often taught to lead and give, but seldom to recognize and receive what is good in other cultures. We ignore our debt to multiple past cultures and often think our own culture, our own realities, our own selves, free of cultural bounds. We study our own beliefs, but more seldom the belief systems and cultures of those we hope to lead. We often preach humility and seldom admire it. We may ignore either our similarities or our differences with others, and thereby limit our ability to find fertile common ground. We may miss the more pervasive sense of the sacred, or the depth and permanency of relationships, the rejoicing in beauty, the stewardship of nature that are more evident in some societies than in our own. Among these are such common problems that we all can find examples of them in our experience and acquaintance. Among traditional Navajos, prayer has begun before sunrise and continues throughout the day. A prospective convert was surprised when missionaries tried to teach him to pray at designated times. Hopis, for their long history, have used corn, grown corn, dried corn, raised corn, stored corn. When two earnest LDS couple missionaries came to help them, they tried to teach them the Mormon idea of a one-year supply of food. Well, they had been practicing a many-year supply of food with their dried corn. But the couple insisted that it be wheat, not corn. When the Hopi said, we don't use wheat, we eat corn, we store corn, our corn is sacred, it's our life, the missionary couple insisted on wheat, and the attendance in that Hopi ward dwindled to a very small group because they didn't know how they could trust a church that was so ignorant and arrogant. Many examples. Charles Anoia used to speak, when he was still alive, used to speak of his marvelous wife Bessie as, quote, this worthless woman. When I asked why, he said it was so other men would not feel their own wives to be inferior. And yet in our society, we praise our lovely wives and other people's lovely wives. The idea of praise and accomplishment and ambition, which are so important to our people, are seen as arrogance for many others. Another interesting little detail, in Cambodia, a beautiful LDS chapel was built with, somehow, I don't know how the members did it, but they had marble floors and inlaid wood, and they included in the men's bathroom installation of the traditional little tubes Cambodian men used to clean themselves after elimination. The American missionary couple assigned to clean the chapel didn't like to clean those tubes, understandably, so had them removed. Cambodian members were puzzled. Does the LDS gospel not encourage cleanliness? I'm familiar, I know, with many of this kind of examples. Efficiency, central planning, corporate identity, marketing surveys, standardization of the product, statistical averages, top-down administration, etc., are characteristic of American businesses and have become our mode of delivery for gospel principles and practice. Their adoption has been useful to the growth of our church and necessary to the sustenance of so large a church, but examples abound of their limitations. Statistical averages do not effectively represent individuals or groups at the end of the bell curve, but bell curve is useful because usually corporate entities are more interested in the size of the herd than in lost sheep. Some 20 years ago, a new chapel was needed to replace the aged building in which a couple of wards were meeting in Calgary, Alberta. Based upon their ward populations and average church activity rates, the building committee in Salt Lake assigned the ward a standard, smaller building plan. But Cardston is a Mormon town. Activity rates are close to 100%, far above the church average. Local leaders suggested the need for cloakroom space. The building committee said members could sit in what they wore to church, but winter temperatures sometimes plunge to 51 degrees below zero Fahrenheit, and a storm may dump 3 to 4 feet of snow. The local leaders pled with the building committee with no success, but finally Presiding Bishop Brown went up, consulted with local leaders, and an appropriate chapel was built. At a regional meeting years ago in Provo, Elder Packer told us he had just returned from a trip to Africa where, seeing local conditions, he had begun to reconsider where and how members of our church might meet. But general authorities cannot go everywhere. They cannot consult always with local leaders for first-hand observations, and feedbacks presently in the church administration are less than comprehensive, depending as they do upon busy male priesthood leaders to busy male priesthood leaders for assessments and communications. Top-down administration and down-up administration does not always reveal important local conditions and context. Years ago, when a chapel was proposed for Soweto, South Africa, as usual, a male LDS representative flew to Johannesburg, consulted with local Caucasian priesthood leaders, and purchased a site for the Soweto chapel. According to Zulu Julia Mavimbela, who stayed with me, LDS Zulu women knew about problems, important problems, with the selected site, but had not been informed either about the discussions or about the location. There was no consultation with the women who were going to use the chapel. There was no opportunity for their informed advice. A major problem, I think, with our church is an inadequate feedback system for many reasons in many contexts. In Samoa, an important visitor is honored with when an important visitor arrives. The people prepare a major speech for the occasion and music composed to the occasion, putting the visitor's coming in context with Samoan history and the beauties and harmonies of the natural world and the joy of people welcoming their guest. A speaker begins with the creation and likens the visitor's coming to other uniquely important historical events. But when an LDS general authority was scheduled to visit Samoa, he asked for a more American meeting with time limits and more prosaic ceremony. LDS meetings are usually technical prose, not spiritual poetry. Spiritual expression and worship, if they occur in our country, are time-bound. Whatever else they may do for the worshiper, even hymns function as alarm clocks signaling when to begin or end something. The timing is necessary to efficient use of the building. Three American wards cannot use the same meeting house, unless they stick to schedules. There is no time for spontaneous experience. It has to be planned and timed. Mormons regularly enjoy or endure years of didactic redundancy in at least 3 hours of standard weekly meetings. As in much of Europe and the Far East, most Canadians either do not construe instructional meetings as prime spiritual venues or are among the faithful few committed to regular meetings in their own congregations and unlikely to join another. Though a majority of Canadians consider themselves religious, only 10 to 20% of them attend regular church meetings. This is a challenge, either for thoughtful Canadians or for prospective converts. In Taiwan, religion is considered largely a private matter. So again, our meeting schedules, which become our prime religious venue, are not inviting. In an attempt to make all teaching more universally culture-free, our curriculum, church curriculum department has made our manuals less universally appropriate rather than more so. For example, food is important to any Marshallese activity or ceremony or celebration, but church policy dictated there be no kitchen in the church. Given high rates of malnutrition, disease, flies eating garbage in the streets, Ebi women were eager for instruction in local nutrition and health issues, which Helen Claire Sievers had been giving them before there was a more formal church organization. Old Relief Society lessons addressed such matters, but present American church leaders assume these to be outdated. Who needs to be told anything about clean water and a balanced diet? So our instruction manuals for Relief Society and primary are primarily gospel instruction, not help in living well with health and good management where they are. Local practical needs have not been included in church business management curriculum planning. I'm sorry, I didn't look at time when I started. How much time do I have? Another problem, I read the church, the newer church missionary manual, Teach My Gospel, and found that in every lesson, the missionaries are to ask those they are teaching for a commitment. Commit to reading the Book of Mormon. Commit to attending church the coming Sunday. Commit to baptism, possibly. Commit to prayer. In some cultures, that kind of quick commitment is completely foreign, particularly when you are addressing people's core values, their core sense of who they are and what it is to be alive in the world. You do not make a life-changing commitment just because someone asks you to on the spot. There are several results of this. In many countries, including Wales and Central and South America and Japan, if an appointment, a succeeding appointment is made, the people aren't home. And the missionaries ascribe this to various things, such as laziness or undependability or just plain disappointment. But in fact, in many of those countries, the people think they have already made it clear they don't want the missionaries, but are too polite to say so. In Japan, where there are many ways to say no, they may already have said it in every polite way they know, but the missionaries, with their minimal Japanese, don't recognize no when they hear it. So a lot of the failure to follow through of prospective converts is highly cultural, but not in the way that some missionaries see it. Up Rock Canyon, met Gary Browning a couple of weeks ago, who is the patriarch for all of Russia, and I asked him what he was encountering there. He said that formerly, as Brother Tyler has said, the missionaries welcomed American culture. Now they reject it. They hate it. All things American are immediately a red flag, which is one reason that the church has quit sending missionaries, new missionaries to Russia. He also said, and this I found significant, not only for Russia but elsewhere, he said conversion there is slower and deeper. And a church which is using American sales technique, get commitment from the bird in hand because it may fly the bush, is foreign to the kind of deep soul struggling which comes when somebody encounters even a better, brighter, more hopeful, enlightening way which will change their whole sense of themselves. Slower and deeper will have different results than quicker. As I responded to the title of this session, I thought to ask, is the church too American, is not necessarily, well, it's too big, obviously, for this meeting, but I thought, should we ask if our church is too Old Kingdom Egyptian, too Old Testament Jewish, too Greek, too Persian, too Roman, too German, too Scottish, too English? Because we carry elements from all of these and often forget that we didn't invent them and that God didn't deliver them in a fresh package. We are cultural, and often we are better educated in other people's culture, in what we have to say, than in the origins of what we are saying and what we are doing. I think a major improvement in church retention of active members and inviting of those who don't yet come to our church would come from a better preparation for the people we're going to teach, to learn as much about the people we're going to teach in the MTC as we learn about our own doctrines in the MTC. Some get it from a good mission president, but many get very little. There's one little paragraph in the missionary manual about Buddha, one little paragraph about Muhammad, and yet we send missionaries to convert those people without knowing anything about their beliefs, their values, the things in their societies that we might well adopt in our own. I rejoice in the diversity of God's world. I rejoice in His listening to us and not always just talking to us. And I hope we may become more able to do the same.
Our final presenter will be William A. Wilson, Bert, as he is known presently from Provo. Please, Bert.
Levi, did you feel at all guilty while Francine was talking about time monitors? Levi has held an axe over our heads this last little while to make sure we got through in an appropriate time.
We practice gender discrimination. Women get to go over time.
Okay. You don't. Well, my task today is to talk about the intrusion of American cultural traits into our attempts to persuade Finns to join and stay in the church. Let me say at the outset that I have the highest regard for those in charge of these efforts. This paper should not be seen as a criticism of them, as they do the best they know how to spread the essential gospel message to our brothers and sisters in Finland and elsewhere. It is rather a criticism of all of us and of our inability to see beyond our own cultural limitations as we attempt to make our behavior appropriate and our message understandable and palatable to those we attempt to bring into our fold. In 2002, my wife and I returned from a public affairs mission to Finland. Shortly before our return to the States, a discussion developed about whether we should be replaced by another American couple or by Finns. The Finnish public affairs director for the mission, a fellow I had known since 1953, when he was a little boy, and my companion and I used to eat breakfast at his home at least once a week, thanked us for our good service, but then added that it would probably be better to appoint Finns who would be able to view matters at hand from a more Finnish point of view. Evidently, my native Finnish wife's point of view had been corrupted into an American view during our nearly 50 years of marriage. I was stunned by the comment. I thought that was what Hanna and I had done, that our point of view was a Finnish point of view. Certainly, I believed living in the country on different occasions for over 7 years and participating in a number of Finnish-related experiences had turned me into about the closest thing to a Finnish clone that one could get. In preparation for this talk, I mailed a friend, a church member in Finland, for his opinion on cultural awareness among church leaders. He replied, "I would probably say that the overwhelmingly American leadership is for sure one thing. I remember hearing a former state president saying that they would listen to the visiting authority and then apply what was okay for Finland. But many things just went in through one ear and out the other because it really wasn't applicable." Now the public affairs director was putting me in this same American category. How could he do that? I was disappointed and hurt. But the more I thought about this matter, the more I could see in many instances the director was correct. I was too American. On our mission, we worked hard to get the Finnish National Director of the Department of Education, Jukka Sarjala, to BYU, to meet our faculty and students and to give a public address. This turned out to be a very successful venture. On his return from the States, Sarjala and his wife drove Hannele and me from Helsinki to Turku for dinner with the Tampere State Public Affairs Director, Kari Haikkola, who had played a key role in bringing this event to pass. On our drive, both coming and going, Sarjala and I spoke very little. I made several attempts at conversation. He always replied courteously, but then let the conversation die. I wondered how I might have offended him. Later, I remembered what I already knew but had not put into practice. That is, that Finns, and especially Finnish men, do not like and do not participate in small talk. For example, as a couple's golden wedding anniversary approached, so it is told, the wife was moping around and her husband asked, what was the matter? She said, "You never tell me you love me." He said, "Didn't I tell you that the day we were married?" "Yes," she demurred. "Well," he said gruffly, "I haven't changed my mind." And so it is. So it was with Jukka Sarjala. He wasn't being impolite. He was just being Finnish. He spoke when he had something important to say. He was not bothered at all by the empty spaces in our conversation. But he may have been bothered by my attempts to fill these spaces with foolish chatter. I can just imagine him telling his workmates, "Be careful of those Mormon missionaries. They never stop talking." At another visit of Haikola and me with Sarjala in his office, he turned to Haikola with an inquisitive look on his face and said, pointing to me, "I can understand that Wilson is Mormon. He's an American. But you are Finnish." The occasion provided Haikola a wonderful opportunity to relate his conversion story, but it also brought home forcefully to me that in spite of all our efforts, the Finns still see the Mormon Church as an American church foreign to the Finnish way of life. I'll never forget Sarjala's sense of wonder that Haikola, a very successful Finnish lawyer, could be a Mormon. I have related these anecdotes for two reasons. First, to warn you to take what I say with a grain of salt, because in spite of all my experiences and attempts to become Finnish, I still speak as an outsider, as an American. Second, to illustrate how difficult it is to get inside another culture and to teach the gospel within that different cultural framework. Finland has sometimes been called the most Americanized country in Europe. The differences between us and the Finns are not as sharp as they are between ourselves and people of other lands. But though they may be small, they still inhibit us from doing successful missionary work. I have always thought that before we attempt to take the gospel to another culture, we should do two things. First, from the essential gospel we wish to teach, we should clearly separate out features that are American. This is no easy task, especially for our young elders and sisters. If their parents, at least those living in my ward, cannot clearly distinguish between the principles of the gospel and the principles of the Republican Party, how then do we expect these young men and women to make the nice distinctions between being American and being Mormon? Second, before beginning missionary work anywhere, we should attempt careful anthropological studies of the target cultures in order to present the gospel message from which we now, I hope, have removed American features in ways understandable to particular peoples. This does not mean abandoning or watering down any of the principles we hold clear, dear. The essential gospel should be what we teach, but it does mean that we should spend a great deal of effort to present a concept within a different cultural framework in a way that it cannot be misunderstood. A good Finnish friend told me one day that she had been an active member of our church a number of years before she fully understood the Mormon concept of authority. I thought, good grief, if we have trouble teaching such a seemingly simple concept to a Finn whose culture is very similar to our own, what hope do we have of getting the message across to non-Christian peoples or to people with no religion? I have little hope that either of my wishes will be acted upon or even considered valid. It is not my place to tell church leaders how to run the church or conduct missionary efforts. But what I can do is be sure I no longer make some of the cultural mistakes I have made in the past. And to the degree that I have any influence with others, help them to pay more attention to cultural barriers separating us from each other. The cultural problems that inhibit the acceptance and growth of the church fall into three broad categories, at least in Finland. About all I can do is mention them here and give a brief example or two. The first barrier is simply ignorance of the fact that cultures really do differ from each other. During the years I taught freshman composition, one of my most difficult tasks was to get students to examine the validity of the assumptions on which they based their arguments, and not to assume that their way of viewing the world was the only correct way. The conclusions they reached in their papers often followed logically from their assumptions about race, about gender, about religion, about politics, about diets, about proper behaviors. But the assumptions, which they took as givens, were often highly suspect. Similarly, as we move into a foreign culture, we often take our assumptions with us and draw wrong conclusions about those we are trying to reach. Missionaries tracking from door to door in Finland may get rebuffed. And to oil my pipes to keep talking here. Missionaries tracking from door to door in Finland may get rebuffed at almost every turn, sometimes quite brusquely, and conclude that the Finns are ill-mannered punks who care nothing for religion. On the other side of these doors are Finns who see the missionaries as brash young Americans trying to push their beliefs on others. In all likelihood, both the Finns and the missionaries are decent people who in different circumstances might get along famously. Finns are very private people. I don't know a single one of them who would ever consider entering the home of a stranger and start asking questions about the occupant's religion. It simply would not happen. They make wonderful friends, but they do not make friends quickly. And they resent any stranger trying to be overly friendly with them. Only drunks do that. Following the demise of the Soviet Union in 1990 and 91, Finland suffered a severe economic depression, and the unemployment rate rose dramatically. A good friend from the church drove by Hannele's home where we were living for the year and asked if I could go for a ride with him. I knew that he had just lost his job, and he knew that I knew he had. We drove around town and the countryside looking at different scenes. We drove up a hill that gave us a good view of the city. We got out and looked. Then he brought me home. During that entire time, neither of us mentioned his job loss and his impending financial disaster. In fact, we talked very little. He didn't need to talk. He needed the companionship of a close friend to see him through the day. During that day, a bonding took place between us that could not have been achieved with words. Somehow, we have to find a way for missionaries to bond with Finns before preaching to them. I confess that I do not know what that way is. Many different ways have been tried. But I know that with rare exceptions, tracting has not been successful in the past and will not be in the future. The second cultural problem we face in Finland is the use of one-size-fits-all mentality. We served our mission shortly after the time every organization, including the church, was creating home pages for the internet or for the web. Finland has long been a leader in telecommunications and computer technology. After all, they gave us Nokia. Several of our people created the best church website I have ever seen. It was not just technologically superior. Everything on it was tied intimately to cultural phenomena most Finns would identify with easily. It spoke a Finnish cultural language to Finns. Unfortunately, it did not fit the website model that had been developed in Frankfurt, so we had to abandon our site. The fill-in-the-blanks model we got from Frankfurt was not bad. It was just not Finnish. It was German. I realized that if every country in which the church is located develops its own website, a crazy quilt pattern could soon follow. On the other hand, we occasionally have to trust people. The fellow who created the Finnish site had twice been a state president, had been in the mission presidency, and had a knowledge of the gospel that would put many of us to shame. He was not going to insert anything inappropriate into the site. It seems to me that a little website oversight might diminish the possibility of these sites going astray. True, it is much easier to hold every country to the same standard model, but in doing so, we lose the possibility of reaching the people we most want to influence. The third barrier to understanding is not so much the intrusion of American features, but rather the exclusion of local customs. Many Finns begin to doubt our Christianity when they observe that we do not celebrate a special Christmas church on Christmas morning, or Good Friday, one of Finland's most solemn religious holidays. It would do nothing to our message to celebrate these occasions with our Christian friends. In 2002, a shockwave traveled across the Finnish mission when missionaries were told they could no longer attend the centuries-old and much-revered Finnish sauna. The mission president, who had a sauna in his own home, knew the change was coming and tried to forestall it, but to no avail. In Finland, the sauna is a national institution. The country has 1.7 million saunas, one for every three Finns. It is one of the clearest markers of Finnish identity available. People who come here, for example, Finns who come to live for a year, they lament the loss of the sauna. It's the sauna and rye bread are the two things they think they have to get back to. There's a Finnish exchange student just living with my daughter and her husband. And he finally finished the sauna he was building in his home, and that made her much happier. But the sauna is the place Finns go to unwind, to relax the body, and soothe the mind. An old Finnish proverb states people should behave in the sauna as they do in church. Another states the sauna is a holy place. You must not swear in the sauna. Until the middle of the last century, babies were very often delivered in the sauna. It was one of the few clean places. Healing ceremonies of all sorts were practiced there. To a Finn, deprecating the sauna would be akin in this country to spitting on or trampling on the American flag. I have neither time, inclination, nor knowledge to detail the events that led to this decision. I will say only that though the Germans have corrupted the sauna in their own country, a fact that the Finns deplored, and I would add that no decent person ever ought to go to a sauna in Germany, but that's Germany, that's not Finland. The widespread belief that mixed bathing is customary in the Finnish sauna is completely false, as is the belief that the sauna is a place for sexual activity of any variety. Men and women do not sauna together unless they are in the same family. One gender takes its turn and then the other. Further, the Finnish Sauna Society's rule book states, the temperature of the sauna should not be more than 80 or 90 degrees Celsius, 100 at most. And I remind you that 100 is the boiling point. As one who has been in a sauna when the temperature approached 100 degrees, I can attest that that temperatures such as this, that in these temperatures, sex of any kind is the last thing on anyone's mind. I was even in one where the temperature got up to 105, and I thought for sure I was going to die. Fortunately, we were by a lake, and I went out and fell into the lake and revived myself. But the sauna is not the place for sex, as I say, of any variety. Had those making the sauna decision taken the time really to learn about the sauna and about its crucial, age-old cultural importance to the Finnish people, and had they learned that the sauna is about the most sexless place on the globe, the decision might have been different, and the possibility of offending potential converts would have been greatly lessened. Let me just add to this that When I served my mission in 1953 to 56, the mission president, Henry Mattis, born in this country from Finnish parents, took us all aside when we arrived there, the group that I was with, and he said, "You have two obligations these next few years. The first one is to be an ambassador of the gospel of Jesus Christ, to take that message to our Finnish brothers and sisters and help them have an opportunity to participate and receive their salvation through gospel ordinances. The second obligation you have is to learn as much as you possibly can about Finland while you are here, so that when you go home, you can be an ambassador for Finland and tell the people back home what it's like, what the Finnish members are like. It's incomprehensible to me that missionaries are not allowed to read newspapers, for example. How can you possibly talk with people who expect you to be literate enough, at least have some notion about what's going on in the world?" Well, I have tried very much through my life to follow President Mattis's two encouragements. One, to do what I could to share the gospel with the Finns, and to do also what I could to make the Finns knowable to Americans. I hope that we will continue that process, and that a cultural sensitivity that is too often lacking will be developed. Thanks.
Okay, there's 10 minutes for discussion. If you would like to ask a question or make a comment, would you please come to the mic here and make your comment? And yeah, okay, there's an empty chair here too for you. You could sit there. All right, please give your name and then make your question.
I'm Doug Bowen. I was interested in Bert's comment about not honoring the traditions and holidays of the country you're in. In addition to that, we often impose our own holidays. When I was a missionary in Germany back in the early 70s, we had a 24th of July celebration. And in a lot of German wars, there were so many of the men killed during the war that they're mainly elderly ladies. And we had all these old women dressed up in whatever they could figure out was pioneer garb, standing on little platforms, little stools, and reading pioneer reminiscences. And if it hadn't been so sad, it would have been funny. And it just had nothing to do with their background or anything. I also like to mention my family lived in Eastern Africa in the 70s. And they tried to operate a small church organization there. And Salt Lake decided that the administrative center would be South Africa. Of course, this was before the end of apartheid, and in Kenya and other places, they wouldn't even allow mail back and forth. So it just shows a real disconnect, insensitivity somewhere. Why would anyone have made that administrative decision? It was eventually changed.
I would say that we ought to continue holding 24th of July celebrations, but different kinds, so that in each country we would honor the church's pioneers in that country and the contributions they have made. I know stories of the early church Finnish members that will match easily any of the stories we hear on the 24th of July about my pioneer.
Thank you. Next, please.
My name is Dale Reese, and whenever I bring up this subject, people just kind of giggle, and they think it's so trivial, why do I worry about it? But it's the white shirt and tie thing. I didn't hear any of you talk about that. But I know the Church News a couple of years ago had an article about a couple of senior missionaries in Africa somewhere, where it was just saying how wonderful it was that they were able to get their ward and other people back home to send white shirts and ties, because there were two units that were meeting in a building, and the men, in order to walk into priesthood meeting, they would change shirts with each other, and we needed to get those for everybody. And then in my own ward several years ago, someone who had a child or a kid and an elder in South America, they wanted all of us to send white shirts down. And I don't think it's a funny thing. I'm concerned about that. That's why I don't wear white shirts to church. You know, I just don't do it.
Steve, do you want to apply your doctrine of Christian disobedience to that?
Well, I can only say that I agree. In Russia, we had the same experience where young men would come to church and the missionaries would supply them with a white shirt so they could pass the sacrament. Made no sense at all.
Thank you. Okay, please. All right.
Something on the same subject. We had a patriarch in our stake in Seattle. Can you hear?
Come on up quick to the mic.
And he had a thing about that we should always have white bread for the sacrament. And he made a big deal about it, but of course he did lose out because we use all sorts of bread all over the church for the sacrament, and it would seem to me we could use all sorts of shirts as well.
Okay, thank you. Next, please.
Can I add a thing to this? In Strasbourg, when Frederick Martin was living there, the branch president, who was from England, wouldn't allow them to use French bread for the sacrament. It had to be soft bread. And he said, clear across the city, there are only two places you could get proper soft, soggy bread rather than crusty French bread.
The next, please.
My name is Dan Thompson. I served a mission in Switzerland in the early 70s, and I remember teaching a primary class one time, an object lesson, translated in German in the manual about honesty that dealt with George Washington chopping down the cherry tree. They had no idea what it was like. I couldn't even begin to explain to them what that was about.
Then you'd have to explain that it never happened in the
first place. Well, they were just beginning to create their own manuals, not just doing straight translation in Frankfurt at the time. I had no idea that Frankfurt was the center for church material dissemination, even up into Scandinavia. It seems
like the Central European area.
Yeah. Well, I was sort of disheartened, too, when they came out with a directive that all the church missions had to be renamed so that it didn't seem that they were culturally inclusive. Instead of being the Swiss mission, they became the Switzerland mission. So that people understood that there was nothing Swiss about this mission at all. That was
What was it? What was the renamed to?
The Swiss, from the Swiss mission to the Switzerland mission.
Oh.
So it is strictly geographically based instead of culturally based. Did I really understand correctly that you said the mission presidents no longer go through a cultural training before they go out?
I don't believe the mission presidents go to the MTC anymore. I think they have a...
Steve, you're sure talking to that, Mike.
I'm sure there's a period of training, but I think it's a week or maybe two.
It's 4 days.
Is it? Wow. So is there no... I just assume that Sunstone, about 10, 12 years ago, there was a lot of discussion about the church running into the worldwide environment and how they were going to grow there. And we talked a lot about how this cultural exchange had to happen, and I just assumed the church would normally take feedback from all the different areas, and particularly interview people who came back from missions and find out where things needed to be changed. And so, yeah. I guess they didn't do it.
Thank you. Charlotte, please.
Okay, this one is shorter. there are just a couple of things that come to my mind. It was after the baseball big conversion thing that was going on in Europe, and then they were trying to, you know, bring that back to normal again. Duff Haines was sent to England, and he had the missionaries read a book on the culture of England, so they would have an understanding of the people they were serving. And when Gene and I were serving our mission in Samoa, President McKay came through and visited the mission, and everybody was wondering if he would take the kava drink that was part of the big ceremony that was, you know, it was an honor. It was a way of honoring a guest, and he did. I mean, he did that, and he just participated in anything that the customs that the people had. And oftentimes there, when we were laboring out in a little village where there was no bread, we had breadfruit or we had taro for the sacrament. It wasn't, you know, whether that's changed now, I don't know. That was 50 years ago. So, but I mean, it is possible if you just, well, anyway, I'm trying to rationalize.
That's the Christian obedience instead of outrageous obedience, please. Let's see, Tom, do you want to say anything on this in this respect? You've traveled, I think, this is Tom Rogers.
Well, I'm the other patriarch to Eastern Europe, so don't use the definite article. Fancy. That honors a man, right? Yes, I go over every 6 weeks or 3 weeks to a month to Eastern Europe. And I do admire the efforts. You know, when Elder Christofferson addressed us at the last conference as our new apostle, he mentioned that his former colleagues, the 70s, are the workhorses of this church. And those who serve in area presidencies are that. And I admire them immensely and all that they try to do. And yes, we and they are all culturally bound and limited, and it would be wonderful if we had a greater perspective on the meaningless differences that we insist upon. And everything that's been said here, I agree fully with that. Bert, I was talking to a missionary couple in Samara, Russia, about a month ago, who are German, but they commented that in the village where this German brother has roots, they had gone back to do family history research, not by assignment, on their own. They had gotten acquainted with distant relatives, with people whose roots are theirs as well, and they have made friends that way, you know, that an indirect, soft approach, which it seems to me that we could do more on our own, a lot of us who have ancestry in other places. That might even be more effective than the overt proselyting at times. Proselytizing. That's about all I can say.
Thank you. Well, our time is up. I appreciate very much your attendance.